apparently a very competitive author at the Albert Einstein Institute, where he's a group leader. Today he's going to speak on what is space made of.
Okay, so thanks a lot to Lucien and everybody here at PI for the invitation. Can you hear me fine? Yeah? I'm not going to speak louder, so I'll turn on the... Is that all right? Is that better? All right, so I'm not going to tell you what space is made of. I will give you a short introduction to a class of models on which we're working. They are models for quantum gravity, as you would have guessed from the title. And they are field theories whose quanta have the interpretation of being the candidate building blocks of space. That's where the title comes from. So the talk is not supposed to be very technical, and I'll get to an overview of the results only towards the end. But of course, I have lots of bonus material, as usual, in case you have questions and you want to have more technical details. So the plan is to introduce the general ideas. And if by the end of the talk you got the general ideas of these models and the purpose and the goals, well, that's more than enough. And I will introduce these models called group field theories and tensor models from matrix models. Okay, so let me first flash the ideas, the general ideas. So the general picture, the general hypothesis behind this class of models, I think, is that macroscopic continuum space and space-time are actually made out of microscopic, discrete, and quantum degrees of freedom building blocks. So there are several reasons to believe that the space-time is fundamentally discrete, and I've learned many of them from Raphael. So one is the general idea that the Planck length plays the role of some sort of fundamental cutoff, or maybe better, is the breakdown scale of the continuum approximation. There are several results in black hole entropy. First of all, the very finiteness of black hole entropy is a little bit puzzling from the point of view of a continuum space-time. Black hole entropy is the entropy of a region of space. So if the space is continuum and geometry is continuum, why should that be finite? That's a very rough idea, of course. Then there's the issue of infinities in quantum field theories and singularities in GR that somehow suggest that maybe the underlying picture of a continuum space-time is not really most fundamental. These are just suggestions. And again, learn from Raphael that Albert Einstein had an interesting quote of that. Somehow you can read it by yourself. I don't like when people read quotes to me. But somehow suggesting that the idea of a breakdown of the continuum and rather a discontinuous picture for space-time is a possibility. He was already imagining that, and it was not against the possibility that future developments will actually lead the theoretical physics there. Okay, so I will call this pre-geometric discrete and quantum degrees of freedom the most fundamental microscopic structure of space, is what I would loosely call the atoms of quantum space. The second general idea is that if the first thing is true, well, then continuum space-time should and continuum geometry would result from a sort of collective behavior of many such atoms of space. And this usually indicates that there is a phase transition going on from a certain description of space to an entirely different one resulting from collective behavior. Now, the main reason why you would expect a phase transition as soon as you start questioning what is the collective behavior of many degrees of freedom, well, it's simply the fact that phase transitions and bound states are really most generic in physics. I mean, whenever there is an interacting system, many built out of many degrees of freedom, a phase transition is almost inevitable, at least in our experience. And then, okay, there are several other reasons which I instead learned from Van Zandt. Is that if you believe that the renormalization group and the idea of renormalizability will still be a key notion at the fundamental level, even if reinterpreted in a different context, well, the fact that a phase transition happens before you bridge the gap from the fundamental microscopic theory to the effective GR, which is non-renormalizable, is actually necessary to explain why a renormalizable field theory or something like that in the microphysics can give rise to a non-renormalizable effective field theory at macroscopic scales. Well, this phase transition is what I will refer to in the following as geometrogenesis. And the name came from, well, the first time I heard it was in a paper by Lee and Fotini and Tomasz Konopka. Lee tells me that it was not his fault, but anyway, it's from there. So this will be a phase transition from a non-geometric or pre-geometric phase to a geometric phase. Okay, let me just try to seduce you to the idea. And so usually when you make it explicit, it doesn't work. So I'll too late now. So you can try to give a cosmological interpretation to what this, to this geometrogenesis, to this phase transition. Well, is the thing that nobody ever tells you about is there. So we understand all very well, and you know much better than I do about the cosmological evolution. And apparently, they tell me, the cosmologists tell me, that we understand very, very well up to there. People debate about this initial stage, the inflationary stage, but they never say anything about this initial part, the very beginning. Well, and again, as I said, there is a little bit of doubts about and discussions about whether there are alternatives to inflation, but this is, again, the standard picture of the story. But even the standard picture has a question mark there. Well, from the point of view I'm trying to advocate, we, the quantum gravity people, are those of the question mark, which actually makes it a very nice slogan, I think. We are the question mark. Okay, so from this point of view, the key questions for any quantum gravity approach are, what are the atoms of space? In your model, what are your candidate atoms of space? And in what formalism, which has to be necessarily background independent in the obvious sense that you have to create a background dynamically, what is the correct formalism for describing the fundamental dynamics? And then, okay, you give me your formalism, and what is exactly, what are the details? What is the specific model you're working on within that formalism? What are the equations? What are the symmetries for the atoms of space? And then, okay, once you have this set up, how does geometrogenesis occur? How does a continuous space-time emerge? And even after you've proven that, you have not yet done, because we are supposed to be doing theoretical physics. And so can you identify and extract effective continuum physics from all of this, from the microscopic theory? So you see that the task is not so much to quantize GR, but actually it's more than that. And that's why we actually didn't succeed yet. And the second part is really like the typical problem of condensed matter physics. I give you the degrees of freedom. How do things organize? Okay, so these are all fundamental and very difficult issues. I'm already looking for excuses for why I'm not giving you all the answers to the questions by the end of the talk. And on this, many clever people have been working since really, really decades. And I have a picture of, I think it was the first quantum gravity workshop. And what? So there are almost indeed philosophical questions, natural philosophy at its best, when we work fine. And You know, and you can see already in that picture, if you've gone to conferences, is the typical type of environment. There are people that prefer to work in a solitary way with deep thinking. That's Heraclitus. And then there are people instead of working in large groups with lots of animated discussion that prefer to collaborate. And that's Euclid with fancy mathematics. And of course, it's a very difficult field. Quantum gravity is even worse than other things. So there, people fail to find jobs or having decent salaries. That's Diogenes there. But the real key issue, as usual, when we do theoretical physics, is that we're always struggling between, you know, our nice mathematical abstraction and physical reality. And apparently these two guys, Plato and Aristotle, have been debating already at this point at the time. All right, so I'm going to focus the talk on a specific class of models, as I anticipated. And it's a really growing area of research, take my word for it, and which also justifies why there have been so many reviews in the last 2 years and so little like the 5 years before. Anyway. So I will refer to you to the literature for most of the details, and I'm happy to give you more references. And it's work of a growing number of people, especially you're very lucky to have a very strong group here at PI. There is another very strong group in Paris with Rivasseau. And well, we have a group at the Albert Einstein Institute that for a good part focuses on this type of models. Okay, so let me get you there slowly and smoothly. So what I think is the smoothest way to get to group field theories and tensor models is to start from matrix models. From there you get to tensor models and you start having the insights and the tools of simplicial gravity path integrals. I'll try to explain a little bit more what these are, so don't worry if you don't recognize things you know already. But then, you know, group field theories really arise. Ah, that was not supposed to show up now. Forget about it for now. So from tensor models, another important and current approach to quantum gravity is dynamical triangulations, especially in the causal version recently, that also can be seen as coming out of the idea of tensor models, at least historically. I hope that this somehow is fine to the people working. Which are here. And well, in parallel to the development of matrix models, well, the approach of loop quantum gravity was also being started, which led recently. So loop quantum gravity started as a canonical quantization of GR. Then it developed into a more covariant version, which is spin foams. It's a sort of path integral version of loop quantum gravity, at least in the intentions. And then more and more we discover relations between the simplicial gravity approach and spin foam models. Well, and group field theories are a version of tensor models, which are strictly related to spin foam models. And actually, historically, the big push for group field theories came from spin foam models, which incorporate insights from simplicial path integrals as well. I'll show you exactly this in the following. And then, okay, I will mention some tools coming from non-commutative geometry, also adding to the set of tools of group field theories. Then there is an issue of names. So we've been discussing with the people in the field a lot. One can just say, look, I mean, the type of models we're working on are a peculiar type of field theories that you can call tensorial field theories. And then depending on the specific models you work on and the type of ingredients you put in, then you can subdivide into group field theories and tensor models. In practice, it doesn't really matter much. I'll tell you the models and then call them as you like. Okay, so let's start from matrix models. The basic idea of matrix models was to, and I would say the basic insight we obtained from matrix models was that you can try to define space-time as a superposition of cellular complexes, of discrete structures. And that this superposition can be generated by something like a field theory. So the cellular complex would be like the Feynman diagrams of the field theory, and you know that the field theory generates in perturbative expansion a sum over Feynman diagrams. In this case, it would be a sum over cellular complexes. I'll show you this in a second. So space-time is really like a statistical system here. And also, matrix models provide a very simple example of a geometrogenesis. Of course, they apply to two-dimensional quantum gravity. So you may object it is too easy an example. And that's true, but that also motivates why we try to repeat the success or reproduce the basic idea in higher dimensions. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about matrix models. So, as I said, the idea is quantum space-time, two-dimensional space-time as a superposition of discrete surfaces. So the basic building block for the example I'm going to talk about is an Hermitian matrix, so an object with two indices. You can represent it graphically, so the indices go from 1 to n, so it's an n by n matrix. And you can represent it as a line with the two vertices labeled by the indices. Then you write down an action for this. Okay, the action is just a particular pattern of contraction of the indices. So it's basically the trace of the cube of the matrix and the trace of the square with a certain coupling constant. And okay, there is a rescaling by the dimension of the matrix, which is just a technical thing. And the way you choose the contraction of the indices has the following property, that if you think of each matrix as representing a line, then the contraction of the indices associated to the vertices mimics the gluing of three edges to form a triangle, okay? Alternatively, you can represent the matrices by two lines, and then this is the combinatorial pattern of indices identification. Okay, you still with me here? Good, good. Notice that at this stage, there's no input from GR. It's really pure combinatorics, okay? Okay, then you write down your path integral for the matrix model. You expand in Feynman diagrams, gamma. By construction, these Feynman diagrams are dual to simplicial complexes, to triangulations. As I said, because the vertices can be represented graphically as triangles, and you glue them together with propagators that are just the gluing of triangles along edges. And this is the amplitude. Very simple, it's just a function of the coupling constant and of the dimension of the matrix. And the object that appears here is the Euler characteristic of the surface. Okay, it's a topological invariant for the surface. It tells you which topology it has. So this is a piece of a Feynman diagram. This line, I think, is just due to me not being very able to draw with the whatever software I use. So it's supposed to represent the fact that this edge is identified with this. Then you say, okay, this is all very nice. It's pure combinatorics. So what is the relation with gravity, at least discrete gravity? Well, you can discretize two-dimensional gravity on a two-dimensional equilateral triangulation, and you get exactly this expression. So this is the continuum one, and this is the corresponding discrete one. This is the Euler characteristic multiplied by the inverse of the G Newton, and there is the number of triangles multiplied by a cosmological constant and the size of each edge. So here I'm just discretizing 2D continuum GR on an equilateral triangulation. Well, and then you can, by appropriate identification of constants, you can see that for each diagram, for each triangulation, what you have here is a sort of a discrete version of a 2D gravity path integral. So the idea is that you have a sum over geometries, of course, pretty trivial, because the only geometric quantity is the total area, and a sum over all possible topologies in 2D, because you sum over all possible ways of gluing triangles together. Okay, there's no restriction a priori. Okay, so that's your definition of two-dimensional quantum gravity, but is it useful? So first of all, can you control the sum over topologies? And the key fact is that because it's a topological expansion governed by the genus, by the Euler characteristic of the triangulation, well, you can show that you can see quite easily from the previous expression that when n is very large, the dominant configurations are those with genus zero, so the sphere or the planar diagrams, okay? So you can control the sum. This is not good enough for 2D gravity because you want to ask about the continuum limit. And what happens is that indeed you can find non-trivial critical behavior. You can see, for example, that the average number of simplices, average number of triangles, diverges. So you can resum all the series in the planar limit, all the spherical diagrams. And you find that the average number of triangles diverges when the coupling constant approaches a critical value. So that's the sign of a critical phenomena, of a phase transition, of a regime that is dominated by configurations with very many triangles, so basically continuum ones. Okay, this is quite sketchy, but and there is, of course, much. So, and this, by the way, is really like a condensation to larger continuum surfaces. Anyway, and then there is much more. For example, you can actually identify what is the continuum theory this corresponds to, and it is 2D Liouville gravity. And you can do it in many ways that I don't need to go into. And then there are a huge number of applications of this matrix model formalism beyond 2D gravity. All right. From matrix model, we learned this, and then people try to extend this to tensor models. So let me give you the idea of tensor models. Well, it's roughly the same picture, but in three dimensions and higher. You would like to define a quantum three-dimensional space-time as a superposition of discrete simplicial complexes. Discrete and simplicial is a bit redundant here, but just to get the idea. So instead of a matrix, now you have a tensor with three indices. This is a three-dimensional example. It's an n by n tensor in the sense that each index goes from 0 to n or from 1 to n. And you can picture it, you can represent it as a triangle with the indices associated to the edges now, okay? One dimension up. And then you write down the simplest action you can imagine with the same reasoning. You want the interaction to represent the basic building block of a triangulation of three-dimensional space, a tetrahedron. So four triangles, four tensors, glued together along edges, indices, in the pattern of identification of edges in a tetrahedron. And then the propagator will just glue together tetrahedra along common faces, along common triangles. You still with me? Not? Good. And well, if you get this point, then the idea of group field theories is exactly the same. I will just add a little bit more ingredients. And again, notice that this is basically pure combinatorics. We didn't choose an action for GR or anything like that. Okay, and you repeat the same game. You expand in Feynman diagrams. The Feynman diagrams are three-dimensional triangulations, simplicial complexes. And now you construct your Feynman diagrams by gluing together tetrahedra in all possible ways. You get lots of singular configurations, not only simplicial manifolds. And in principle, you can generalize the construction to arbitrary dimension. The questions, of course, are, first of all, what is the relation with classical and quantum discrete gravity, as I told you about matrix models? And the point is that already simplicial geometry is much richer in dimension higher than 2. Maybe you need the possibility that you need more structure, more data to capture that. And then I show you that in the sum over triangulations, you get lots of singular configurations, and a priori you get all topologies, which we don't know how to classify. So can you control that? Okay, so you would like to have an analog of the large n limit. Okay, I will talk about this later. And then as in matrix models, you want to know about the continuum limit. Is there a phase transition to a continuum happening? So this is about the critical behavior. Okay, and then farther down the line, you would like to extract the continuum physics from it. All right. So these questions are, in particular, the control over the perturbative sum and the continuum limit are extremely difficult, and there's been no real progress until very recently, thanks to the people I mentioned earlier. in particular the group here at PI and the group at, in Paris. And this is where, as far as I understand the history, an alternative was looked for based on the same principle of superposing summing over triangulations, and that's, that was born the dynamical triangulation approach with the most recent results in the causal version, in the Lorentzian and causal version of it. Okay, now I will instead focus on this other question, the relation to discrete, classical, and quantum gravity. So still remaining at the discrete level. And I showed you what the construction principle was. I take a triangle, I glue together four triangles to form a tetrahedron, and so on. And that's my definition of the dynamics. So in 3D, the question we want to address in this context is, what is a quantum triangle, a two-simplex? What data do I need? And then how do I make quantum triangles interact to form a 3D simplicial complex, which has a little bit more structure than the one in tensor models? And you can ask the same question in the 4D case. Okay, so this was what we learned from matrix models and the idea of tensor models. GFT arises when you try to answer the previous questions by bringing in insights and tools from simplicial gravity path integrals and spin form models. Yep, so what we learned from simplicial gravity path integrals is that if we want to restrict to a finite number of degrees of freedom a discretization of GR, well, there are several formulations available, in particular Regge calculus. We know what the classical action should be to have the right properties and symmetries and so on. And from spin form model, well, we learned from loop quantum gravity that the quantum space can be thought of as a superposition of spin networks. And loop quantum gravity provides a possible definition of what quantum geometry may mean. And then in the spin form version, well, a history of a spin network is a spin form. So a complex similar to the one I showed you, decorated with data which are taken from group theory. So representation of groups or group elements. Okay, so we take these two lessons, these two set of lessons on board, and we get to GFTs. And then, okay, there will be something from non-commutative geometry, which is the following. So this is like an interlude, but it may be useful to understand the next slide and the next two slides, maybe three. Well, there is a notion of non-commutative Fourier transform. And so again, I would like to skip the details unless you ask. And you get the basic idea is that just like you get from functions on R3, where R3 is configuration space, to different types of functions on R3, which are in momentum space, well, you can do something similar on groups. In particular, what I'm interested in is SO3 or SU2, the double covering. So you take from functions on the group to the corresponding momentum space, the momentum space being the Lie algebra, okay? So you try to define a unitary map that does that, from functions on the group to functions on the algebra, from configuration to momentum space. And so this slide just has a little bit of details on that, but if you got this point, that's more than enough. You get the point. So your configuration space is the group manifold and your momentum space is the corresponding algebra. And you can define a Fourier transform with a choice of plane waves that does the job. Good. And it was applied recently also to loop quantum gravity, but this is just for your information. Okay, then let's go back to the initial question. What is a quantum triangle? Well, a classical triangle in R3 is just described by three edge vectors, or equivalently three normal vectors to the edges, that close, so that sum to zero. Okay, this sort of elementary geometry. This defines the unique intrinsic geometry of a triangle in R3, of course, up to rotations. And we would like to see this intrinsic geometry as a sort of so it's a part of a phase space. We want to add a little bit of structure. So your intrinsic geometry is given by three vectors that close. What is the extrinsic geometry in the R3 embedding? Well, then we give a look at three-dimensional gravity in first-order form, which is the same as three-dimensional BF theory. So this is the action. You have a triad one form, a connection one form, and its curvature. You take the trace in the Lie algebra because they're both valued in the Lie algebra of SO3 in this case. I'm talking about the Riemannian case, Euclidean gravity for now. And you can discretize this object on an arbitrary three-dimensional complex, an arbitrary three-dimensional triangulation. What you obtain is a discrete triad that is an R3 vector, actually the algebra element for each edge of your triangulation by averaging, so the edge E. And you write down the holonomy of the one-form connection along dual links, so going from one tetrahedron to another. If you've done any lattice gauge theory, you will recognize that this is exactly what you do to discretize a gauge theory. You can write down a discrete action, which has the same type of symmetries and variables at the discrete level of this continuum action, which depends on the curvature around each edge. So you consider all the holonomies going around an edge in the triangulation, and that associates a curvature to that edge. Okay, you go around, as you do in GR, in the continuum. How do you know what is the curvature here? Well, go around it alone. Okay, and the phase space that results from this theory for a triangle is the cotangent bundle of three copies of the cotangent bundle of SU2. So you have one group element per edge, and you have one Lie algebra element per edge. These are the two phase space variables. Lectures are tough, huh? And again, we are not using the rest of the dynamics at this stage. We just want to extract what is the basic phase space structure, the basic variables we need to put on our simplicial complex to incorporate some degrees of freedom of quantum geometry. Okay, so that's the phase space. And then if I want to ask what is a classical tetrahedron in R3, well, I have to glue four triangles constructed like this across common edges. So the edge vectors have to be the same. So a quantum triangle can be written down as a wave function, which is a function of three Lie algebra elements, which close. The star product is because these variables are non-commutative and result from the non-commutative Fourier transform I gave before. Again, it's a choice of a generic function of the three edge variables to be your wave function with a constraint that they have to close. Okay, then you can write it down after Fourier transform in group variables. So remember that the Fourier transform was going from Lie algebra to group elements. And okay, you get a certain expression. You can also expand everything in representations of SU2, and you get a third way of expressing the wave function. So the only message of this slide is the following. You can write the wave function for a triangle as a function of Lie algebra elements of SU2, as a function of group elements of SU2, or as a function of representations of SU2, okay? Keep the message. And then a quantum tetrahedron should again arise by identifying edge vectors across four quantum triangles. Okay, now I just flash you one group field theory model so that you get the general idea of this type of models. And I give you the colored version by Razvan. Don't remember why I decided to give the color version here, apart from paying tribute to a friend. So the main reason, the main point here is that you turn the wave function to a classical field, and you look for writing a field theory action, just like the tensor model action, with that ingredient. And the construction, the definition of the theory is the same as in tensor models. I take four triangles, four fields. Here I wrote everything in the group representation. Each group element is associated to an edge, and I identify them across different triangles, just like the edges of four triangles are identified across in a tetrahedron to form a tetrahedron. And instead of a trace over tensor indices, I have the integration, I have a convolution of fields. Yes?
I'm conceptually confused about your use of word quantum. I guess you're writing down.
This is a classical action.
This is a classical action, yeah. but you're still also calling it quantum triangle. But
so the point is that both historically and I would say also conceptually, the idea of this came from first quantizing simplicial geometry, first quantization, if you want, writing down wave functions and operators and so on. And then came the idea of writing down a field theory.
Oh, but here's classical.
This is a classical action.
Okay, good.
It's a classical field theory action. I just wanted to make the connection between the quantum data of a triangle and the stuff I write here. Thanks for the clarification. So, and then you do like in tensor models. Now I understand why I use the colored version, because pictures look much nicer with colors beyond the tribute. So the point is that, so you do like in tensor models, you expand in Feynman diagrams your field theory. And basically the Feynman diagrams, as I said, have vertices which are like a tetrahedra, or you can represent graphically like this, keeping the same information. You can even simplify the representation and keep track of the colors, but this is, okay, this is an extra bonus feature. And then the propagator will identify triangles across tetrahedra if they have the same color. Okay, something like that, or like that. Can you see it actually, or there's too low resolution? You get the idea at least. Okay, remember to nod. Okay, and then the other basic fact about group field theories is that, as I said, just as you can write the wave function for a triangle or the field, the classical field for the group field theory in different representations, you can write down the amplitudes in different representations. So in group, in terms of group elements, in terms of Lie algebra elements, in terms of representations of the group. Well, and for this model, what happens is the following. If you write everything in group element, in terms of group elements, you get a lattice gauge theory, which is the lattice gauge theory formulation of BF theory, topological BF theory, which is also 3D gravity. If you write in representation space, you get the equivalent expression given by the Ponzano-Regge model, which is a spin form model, actually the oldest one ever written, 68. If you write everything in Lie algebra variables, you get a simplicial path integral, exactly the simplicial path integral for the discrete action I introduced a few slides ago. Okay, so it seems that in this case, at least, just the basic data from the classical phase space incorporated in the group field theory are enough to obtain a nice simplicial path integral at the level of the amplitudes. Okay, so you can show this duality between a spin form model and a simplicial path integral. And C stands for non-commutative, and that's because the variables, as I said, are non-commutative Lie algebra elements. And you can generalize this. And this extends, complements, I would say, an earlier important result that showed that any group field theory gives rise to a spin form model when written in representation space at the level of the Feynman amplitudes. So this is important for loop quantum gravity, of course, as I try to anticipate. Okay, this was just a sort of a summary. So I give you 2 seconds to read it, and I move on. Good. There are questions up to now? There will be questions later, I guess. All right, so I've shown you in what sense you bring in the idea of simplicial path integrals and ingredients of spin form models, and through them, some of the ingredients and ideas from loop quantum gravity. and also some tools for non-commutative geometry. All right, let me summarize what group field theories are. And then I will go to the last part of the talk, obviously. Okay, so group field theories are a new class of tensorial field theories defined either on groups or on Lie algebras. Okay, and you can interpret them as field theories for spin network vertices or quantum simplices. I've shown you that the field can be interpreted as a simplex, a triangle in this three-dimensional example. So the quanta of the field are like triangles that have been created, annihilated. In representation space, they look like spin network vertices, which are also created, annihilated by the field theory dynamics. And it's a tentative definition of the microscopic dynamics of space. And just like in tensor models, both geometry and topology are dynamical. That's good, there's lots of stuff. That's bad, because there's lots of stuff. Okay, I've shown you how you basically arise from bringing in some ingredients from simplicial gravity and loop quantum gravity in the framework of matrix and tensor models. And then being a new class of field theories, well, it poses new challenges, in particular for renormalization theory. We are trying to renormalize theories of this type, and we have to struggle. I mean, we don't have experience in this type of field theories. And also, there are many applications to statistical mechanics, and you're very welcome to refer to Valentin, who is pushing in that direction. So again, the basic ingredient, the interaction process, a Feynman diagram is either a simplicial complex, it's given by a simplicial complex dual to a spin foam. The Feynman amplitude can be written equivalently as a spin foam model or a simplicial path integral. But you have all the full field theory dynamics, endpoint functions, word identities, Schwinger Dysons, and so on. It's a new way of trying to incorporate the dynamics of spin foams and spin networks. The microscopic dynamics is dictated by more elementary simplicial geometry considerations than full dynamics of GR or some other gravitational theory. So as a consequence, is far from it, and we will struggle, and we are struggling to recover GR. And it's a nice framework for the continuum limit and emergent continuum dynamics, because we can use tools from quantum field theory, renormalization, mean field theory, the use of symmetries, and so on. And the idea of summing over triangulations, once more, that here comes because it's in a perturbative expansion of a field theory, is also the root of the dynamical triangulations approach. So we can use and try to learn what they have understood there already and try to incorporate results, or try vice versa to suggest ideas or results. Well, the key questions are always the same. So concerning what are the atoms of space and what is the fundamental dynamics, the formalism, well, I just gave you a candidate. So it's not an answer, it's a candidate answer. And the issue now is the following: what are the proper models to describe quantum gravity and quantum space in this framework? How does a continuum space-time emerge? And how to identify the effective continuum physics? The rest of the talk will be about this work in progress in this. So the main purpose, again, is to try to get across our goal and our motivating hypothesis. And then in the very last minutes, I will give you a very brief overview of the recent results from the last 5 years without details. Then, believe me, I have like 20 slides in case you want to know details about the other things, but there's no plan for discussing any of that in detail. Okay, this, I don't know why it is appearing later. Apparently, I have to learn also to use Keynote. All right, so the idea that I flashed at the beginning, I have no idea what this is. Just to confirm that I have to learn to use Keynote. Is the idea that I was hinting at before, a phase transition from a pre-geometric phase to a geometric continuous phase for quantum space. And of course, I'm working on trying to realize it in the context of tensor models and group field theories, and I will mention mainly that. But it's not a new idea. I mean, it's exactly what people in lattice gravity have been trying to do, quantum Rege calculus. And also in spin forms, there has been work recently from our very Bianca, wherever she is. Hey, Bianca. And with lots of nice results. And I mentioned already dynamical triangulations, especially in the recent causal versions where we have really very many results. And there's so many people that I decided to cite only the founders and a friend. And then I mentioned already the idea that the very name of geometrogenesis, I took it from the quantum gravity paper, which has been pushed mainly by Fotini, Marco Pulo, who is also here. Not now, but normally. Okay, I will focus instead of this on this line of developments. So I think that also this was supposed to show up at the end. Okay, so I already told you what the expectation is, the hope is that physics of continuous space-time will emerge from, first of all, the non-perturbative sector of GFT, not the perturbative one, not the theory and not the physics of a few GFT quanta, in some thermodynamic limit where you actually assemble large numbers of the GFT quanta, GFT building blocks of space, in some specific phase. This is also bad English. Anyway, the important advantage with respect to other attempts to incorporate, to realize this idea is what I mentioned. So the fact that you can really try to use the tools from statistical field theory and condensed matter physics. These are calculational tools, approximation methods, and so on. Now, what is the physical interpretation of this geometrogenesis? Not mine. Well, the first suggestion would be a sort of a condensate of GFT atoms. So quantum space would be a sort of condensed matter system made out of many atoms of space which are GFT quanta. So geometrogenesis would be a sort of GFT condensation. Now, okay, this of course is puzzling. You think about it and you're like, okay, what does that really mean? It's really, really, really weird. And but then, you know, we also know that condensation is all over the place and around us, just as generic phase transitions are, as I said at the very beginning. And I found, as for any interesting thing, I found a BBC documentary that explains very well, first of all, the fact that the condensation is so all over the places, but also the fact that it's still very puzzling. And it's still even more puzzling in this context. And this idea in the GFT and tensor model context has been pushed, been suggested more recently by these people. Okay, so as I said, it's very common and very puzzling phenomenon, condensation.
Previously on condensation.
Ellen, there's moisture on the outside of my glass.
It's condensation, Johnny.
But what about the fog on the windows?
It's not fog, Johnny. It too is called condensation.
Condensation.
Yes. Anyway, so I show you just one example in a couple of slides. Again, to try to get through the idea of what we would like to do in the GFT context, and therefore to introduce what we are doing in technical work, that, which will come in 2 minutes. Well, a Bose condensate. We all know what a Bose condensate is. So we know that the condensate can be described after the phase transition once it has become superfluid in the hydrodynamic approximation. So there are the standard hydrodynamic variables, density of the fluid, the velocity of the fluid. There are the hydrodynamic equations. They can be written and they can be derived in some cases from a Lagrangian. Again, you can, no, it's not very important. I mean, the technical details, again, are not important, but I want to show you an example we almost all know about. And suppose that we try to quantize this theory. We know it's a macroscopic theory. It's the theory for the full fluid. The variables are collective variables. What does happen if we quantize them? Well, first of all, the theory is not normalizable. So we try to turn the variables into operators. Well, it doesn't really work. But first of all, it's not so physically relevant, because even if it was working, the regime were quantum fluctuations of the full fluid, the old density of the fluid, or the velocity become relevant, the old hydrodynamic approximation breaks down. It's not really so useful. But then the point is that if you quantize that and then you try to say, okay, what is the classical limit? Well, it doesn't work. You don't get the initial theory you try to quantize. There is a problem in the commuting, if you want, the operational quantization and the classical limit. But the point is that here all is fine. We know this is just you know, the macroscopic effective theory, or something that is more fundamental. It's a scalar field theory. Is a renormalizable scalar quantum field theory with quartic interactions, as at least in one version. And well, okay, we have an underlying field theory for the atoms. The objects that are created and annihilated here are the atoms. And what we do in order to extract the effective field theory, the hydrodynamics, is first of all, do some approximations to the microscopic theory. Then either prove explicitly when we are very good, or at least argue convincingly for the existence of a phase transitions when we're interested in the last part rather than in the intermediate steps. Identify what is the new condensate vacuum, the new vacuum of the theory where the old system rearranges in a different macroscopic configuration. That is not the Fock vacuum in which there are no atoms whatsoever. And extract effective dynamics using mean field theory or other type of approximations. And people in condensed matter tell me that this is quite dirty. I mean, only in some cases you can actually be as Platonic as you would like to be as a mathematical physicist. Well, so you approximate first of all, the original interaction by a contact interaction. You go away from the Fock vacuum to a condensate vacuum, and then you do mean field theory. You expand the field operator around the new vacuum. You plug it back in the original theory. You move to collective variables from the original field, and here comes the effective field theory. Of course, this is in the situation in which we know that there is a phase transition. We have a good understanding of what is the condensate vacuum, and so on. All this is missing in GFT. The analogy is that maybe quantum space is like a quantum fluid, like a condensate. That some GFT model, or a class of GFT models, because there will be universality classes, of course, is like the microscopic field theory for the atoms of the fluid that is quantum space. That GR is like the effective hydrodynamics for the fluid. And that to go from one to the other, we should be good enough to apply ideas and methods from statistical field theory and condensed matter theory to GFT directly, to our field theory for the atoms. Okay, analogy is over, and I have 5 minutes. Yeah, okay, so I just give you a very quick overview of recent results from the last 5 years. I think it's 5 slides, but not chronological. So, one main question was the one that driven the first part of my talk, was how do we encode quantum geometry in a GFT, at least at the discrete level? What are the ingredients that may be needed to obtain after the phase transition the right continuum physics? We don't know if those are needed, but of course you have to do a bit of model building and check. So as I said, the encoding of geometry is guided by simplicial geometry, simplicial path integrals, loop quantum gravity, spin foams, and so on. But any other suggestion is very welcome. OK, so this is the issue. And the status of the story is the following. We can build up on results from loop quantum gravity and spin foams, which are many. It's like 20 years, if not, well, 25 years, I think, of 25 years in May. Of results. So we can try to use them. The tools for non-commutative geometry that I mentioned allow a better understanding of how this geometry is encoded. And that's also recent work. And the status is we have several models, interesting models for four-dimensional quantum space, I mean, 3+1, both in the Riemannian and Lorentzian case, and we should now try to understand them better and develop them more, and possibly also develop alternatives, just to have a more, how to say, more bullets in our gun. Do you use that in Canada? Something like that. The other main question is, what you have a field theory, what are the symmetries? In particular, if you're interested in gravitational physics, where are the diff fields? So the issue is, what are the symmetries of your specific group field theory model? Of course, they are important for identifying the universality class, for guiding the extraction of effective physics, and so on. And in particular, where are the diff fields? And the status is the following. First of all, the very field theory formalism allows to define and study field theory symmetries for GFT models. That's already good. So we have mathematical tools and lots of experience in dealing with that question. And in the, then the other result is that in a three-dimensional model, we understand what are simplicial diffuse, a discrete remnant of diffeomorphic symmetry in Regge calculus or in simplicial path integrals, thanks to my former advisor, thanks to Bianca, thanks to other people. So we know what are diffuse at the level of the simplicial path integral, which, as I said, is the GFT Feynman amplitude. And recently we understood what is the field symmetry, what is the field transformation at the level of the GFT action for the same type of model in 3D. That corresponds to that symmetry at the level of the simplicial path integral, at the level of the amplitudes. That's something. The next big question is, just like in tensor models, the control over the perturbative expansion. I told you that that's where the initial idea of tensor models got somehow stuck for a while. And then it's a field theory, so we want to understand the scaling with the whatever cutoff you put in your Feynman amplitudes, the divergences, and the sum over topologies encoded in the perturbative expansion. So these are the questions. And the status is that here we have lots of results. Many of these results are obtained in the colored context proposed by Razvan. And we have a very good control over the combinatorial and topological properties of the simplicial complexes, which is hard enough. I mean, simplicial complexes are topologically and combinatorially much, much harder than graphs. And there's many people who worked on this. Then we have several power counting theorems, at least for topological models and for the simple tensor models, again, due to many people. We can show that generically singular manifolds are suppressed compared to manifolds in the expansion. But the most important, we have an analog of the large end limit of matrix models, which is naturally less powerful than the matrix model case where the old expansion was topological. But still, we have an analog of that. You put a cutoff in your Feynman amplitude, and then you ask how the amplitude scale when you remove the cutoff, as you would do in field theory. Well, and we know, thanks to this, I know what it is. I knew it was my father. Sorry. Sorry. I'll kill him. Yes. So this is thanks to Razvan and to Razvan and Vansal. And so we know that in this large cutoff limit, manifolds, as opposed to pseudo-manifolds, or spherical topology, as opposed to any other topology, dominate. That's a very important result. Then you have a field theory. Is it renormalizable? Even when you expand it around the Fock vacuum, is it renormalizable? Well, again, the status is the following. We have, first of all, lots of standard and very rigorous quantum field theory renormalization techniques that can be adapted and applied and are being applied. We have some basic understanding of divergences and needed counter terms in topological models, thanks to Valentin and Joseph here at PI. And most important, we have examples, explicit examples of some rather simplified models, but still highly non-trivial, that have been proven to be renormalizable at all orders. And without, you know, dirty tricks, or, you know, you add the suppressing factors as you wish and so on. I mean, they're interesting models. Next, as I said, you want to know something about the continuum limit. If I knew a lot about the continuum limit of these models, I would not give an introductory talk, and I would just tell you what the continuum theory is and how it works. The issue is mainly whether there is a phase transition to a continuum space, the originating question of this talk. And the status is the following. First of all, you can prove some ability, Borel sum ability for some models. That's interesting. So there is a hope for a non-perturbative control over the perturbation series. And the point that the more important point is that the critical behavior of some tensor models has been studied, and it's important, analytically. So up to now, the work has been entirely analytic. And people find a phase transition, which exact nature depends on the specific model. And this is the two main results. Well, in fact, they deal with different models, and they find different types of phase transitions. Okay, good. And then the other point is, what is the effective continuum physics, or at least how do you approach the problem in these models? And the status is the following. We have a very limited understanding, even for simple tensor models, on what is the effective continuum physics. That's good. There is work to do and possibly jobs. And we have basically no exact results for the more involved models, either the three-dimensional gravity one that I've shown, or even worse, four-dimensional gravity models. It's a fact. Unfortunate, but it's a fact. We have now identified a symmetry for the endpoint functions that generalizes the Virasoro algebra that is found in matrix models. So in that case, it's thanks to this fact, also thanks to this fact, that we know that the continuum theory is a different variant theory in 2D, and it contains at least 2D gravity. So it's important to identify this type of symmetries. And this has been done by Razvan, and we have some recent results in Potsdam. And then these are all the rigorous things, and the previous slide was also the rigorous results, analytic and rigorous. Both things are quite non-trivial. And then we also started a parallel line of investigation. So while we wait to understand better our analytic tools and do the hard work, well, let's do like they do in condensed matter. Let's try to be bold and try to do mean field theory approximations, other rough approximation techniques, and develop a little bit of feeling for what is the effective dynamics. So we used mean field theory approximation, and depending on the context, so we can extract something that looks like an effective classical set of equations for geometry, whose solutions are compatible at least with the solutions of the gravitational theory behind. That's a three-dimensional example. So you want to obtain flatness, which is a very simple type of geometry. You can extract effective Hamiltonian constraints for spin networks from the original group field theory. And you can extract effective non-commutative matter field theories for the excitations around non-trivial vacua, which is also quite interesting. And that's work of many people. Well, many, these ones. And then we, in parallel, again, as you do in condensed matter, you take the fundamental theory and try to solve it as much as possible. You try to approximate it as much as possible. But in parallel, you also try to directly write down some simplified model and hope that either they arise from the fundamental theory or they give you some hint of what the effective physics could be. And we have developed recently a model for quantum cosmology of the GFT type, at least inspired by GFT. Okay, so it's a little bit, I have to thank Vincent for providing the beautiful picture that will be used soon. And I really hope you cannot see the formula here, because they have really nothing to do with the talk. But I didn't know to remove them. I don't have Photoshop, and I have to rely on more clever people to help with that, yes. Okay, so it's, of course, clearly early to draw conclusions. I hope that convinced you that at least there's been really lots of progress, lots of results, recently, but there is a very, very long way to go before we can really say we understand the physics of quantum space or the nature of the atoms, and even more difficult, the process of geometrogenesis. And in particular, we should be able to do both the our Platonic beautiful mathematics and Aristotelian real physics. Thank you. Almost still on time.
Questions?
Yeah, so we use this word, the atoms of space time, or space, whatever. So are you attaching any physical reality to these atoms, like real atoms?
I attach physical reality to them, although if you ask me what it is, I think because we're in different phases, it would be like asking to fishes what are the atoms, what the molecules of water. And I have no idea what the physics of that could be, or even how we could find out what is the physics attached to it, a little number of such degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm slightly confused about this is that you are, at the same time, you are using these as building blocks for a history in your past principle.
So the way I'm posing the question and the way I see it, at least tentatively, is I'm giving you the microscopic field theory for the atoms. And I'm trying to extract effective continuum physics. I'm not denying the physical reality of the atoms, it's just that I don't know exactly what that corresponds to. Really liking the Bose condensate. If I was swimming in a superfluid, very cold, then I would have some effective physics in the continuum, my hydrodynamics. And suppose I was very smart, or people suggested it, which is actually the case, and somebody handed to me the field theory for the atoms. Well, my task would be to try to extract what I know, the effective hydrodynamics from that. And tentatively, I would assign the physical reality to the atoms. But it's very hard to say what that corresponds to or how we would go about it to detect it.
But your atoms, are they the tetrahedra or the triangles or what?
Yeah, in the same sense in which, well, in the same very loose sense in which a particle is a point.
Well, there it's pretty precise, everything.
Well, I mean,
electron is not a loophole. Let's discuss it.
In this sense, I mean, yes.
So if space-time is like some analog of the Bose condensate, what is the singularity at the center of a black hole? Is that going to go away? I'm fully aware of loop quantum cosmology and what's done there, but I still don't see what the picture is, the singularity of a black hole inside a black hole.
I'm not going to tell you what the picture is in loop quantum gravity because there are better experts than me. The tentative idea here was the one that I flashed at the very beginning for geometrogenesis in the cosmological setting. But the singularity is like the approach to a phase transition. You're boiling the fluid.
And what happens?
Ah, well, at some point you have to switch description to the microscopic one in which you don't have this continuous approximation anymore. It's a wild guess. I don't have the result to show you. That would be the picture.
So that would be evaporation instead of condensation?
Yeah, somehow the reverse.
You said you have a preliminary thoughts about a cosmological scenario for condensation, perhaps also evaporation. Would you have something to say, for instance, to the debate on at the evaporation of the black hole? Would the entropy go in the boiling phase, or would they remain on our space? Or could we imagine as a solution of some paradoxes about the fate of black hole?
I'm sure I can, but I haven't thought about it, so I'm not going to try now. Mm-hmm. That would be really exposing myself to ridicule more than I want. But I'm happy to discuss and speculate a lot. It's a very interesting question, indeed.
Yeah, you said you had a limited understanding of the continuum limit of some of the simplified tensor model. So what is set limited understanding? Has it anything to do with macroscopic geometry?
Not what is the effective continuum theory, but only in the sense that we know there is a phase transition, we can compute some critical exponents, and we can tell if it is first or second order, and that at least as far as those limited information is concerned. We don't have an understanding of what is the effective of the continuum theory, if it is an extended four-dimensional space or not. We are currently trying to compute the spectral dimension of the typical diagrams using also your insights, but I cannot report any result yet. So when I say limited understanding, I just mean that you can show that there is a phase transition, you can compute some critical exponents, and that's about it.
In three and four dimensions, you said you had a kind of a limited grasp on the sum over topologies idea, but what kind of invariants have come up? I mean, in the research, is there any topological invariants that kind of stand out to it?
Well,
can you repeat the question?
Topological invariant.
It wasn't audible back then.
Oh. Sorry, I was asking basically what kind of topological invariants have they been using in three and four dimensions?
So as I said, the large n limit that I was referring to is governed by a quantity that unfortunately is not the topological invariant. However, for example, in the three-dimensional case, the dominant value of that quantity is a topological invariant, and it is the Eegard genus. Of an embedded surface in your three-dimensional space. Mm-hmm. So you know that when that is zero, that's a sphere. Mm-hmm. And then the large n expansion depends, the scaling of the amplitudes in those models depend on the fundamental group, which is another way to characterize the topology of your manifold. As I said, it's not a topological expansion, it's not governed by a topological invariant, so it's much more intricate than that. Actually, the best power counting result we have from Valentin and Matteo shows explicitly that the scaling depends on exponent, which is a topological part, depends in fact on the fundamental group and other topological quantities of the simplicial complex. But then it has an explicit dependence on the specific complex you chose. So it's most certainly not the topological quantity overall.
You were talking about the dynamics of those atoms building the space and time. So it means, well, how do they behave in time? But they themselves are the building blocks of time. So so what does it mean? There is a confusion.
Well, here when I say building up space-time, I just mean that what you associate with space-time is the Feynman diagram, while the building blocks are the quanta that you put on your boundaries. So if you're asking for some time variable, well, here we are really in a sort of a timeless framework. But it's kind of natural because we don't even have a continuum geometry, so it's not obvious what we would like to call time here. And in this sense, I was already looking in that direction concerning this. And in this sense, we are in a very different setting than the original geometrogenesis scenario in quantum gravity, where there is an external time variable. It's a variable that is used as it was a time evolution variable. And I think there were.
Questions. I'll go
this year as well.
I'll come back to it.
Okay.
Follow this thread where it's going.
Okay, so indeed, isn't it?
If space time is completely emergent, one of the very basic properties of space is chirality. That in physics, experimentally left handed is distinguishable from right handed. If everything is just made up of interchangeable building blocks, do you have a way that chirality could emerge?
Well, the models I discussed here were just about, the ingredients you put in the models are taken from pure gravity, are supposed to encode pure geometry. Then there's been several papers, and when I say several, I mean probably three or four on the coupling of matter. But studying the effective continuum physics in those more complicated models, including matter degrees of freedom, is even more complicated. So we have really no clue. The best context in which to pose your question and studying it would be the thing I mentioned in the last slide, which is when you try to extract using new field theory approximation a non-commutative field theory. And but that is for a scalar field in the examples we know. So it's hard to say what it, it's hard to check what it tells about the chirality in the emerging space. So it's a very long answer to say I don't know. But thanks for asking.
Question. It's a good question to think about. Because if the atoms are too discrete, then they won't carry notion of chirality.
But you also, you think that chirality is fundamental?
Yes.
But do we have evidence for that?
The simplicity of the Astrophant formulation. One, plus the fact that chirality is a property of the matter degrees.
So in one then can try to ask the question already at the discrete level, even before studying the phase transition, and try to see if there is some sort of hint at the degrees of freedom you're putting inside your model at some form of chirality.
Okay, it's interesting. Of orientation. Yes. Yeah. Atoms carry some notion of orientability.
Yeah. I've not looked into that. I don't think anybody else has. I don't know if the other experts in the room have thought about it.
Did anyone
want
to respond to that? You can respond to this
question. Yeah, I have a question. In this station, is the diffeomorphism invariance of GR an accidental symmetry of the effective theory after the phase transition, or do you think it's more fundamental?
Only model where we have an explicit realization of some form of diffeomorphism invariance at the GFT level, indeed you see that it's a global symmetry of the initial GFT action. So from this point of view, it will be fundamental. It's not an emergent property. But at the same time, what we are talking about there is a sort of discrete remnant of a diffeosymmetry in the continuum, and we know that the same type of transformations, the same type of symmetry, is broken when you do discrete gravity in the same way, but you go to four dimensions. So from this point of view, it could be actually used the other way around. You may look for the regime of the initial model where this symmetry is somehow recovered, at least approximately. And that would be the regime where most likely you should look for the proper type of phase transition and emerging continuum physics. So it's another long answer to say I don't know, but at least we have a guideline for trying to see how to answer the question. And that's what we know at the moment.
Yeah, I think we should probably finish there. You can continue to ask Daniel questions downstairs. There'll be some snacks provided in the bistro. So let's thank Daniel.